I volunteered for Job because I've never really studied Job. The idea of studying somebody who is suffering didn't really appeal to me very much. And I thought, it's time I got to grips with Job. Now, we're not going to look at passages within Job, because if so, we'll lose the forest for the trees when I only have one session. I mean, it needs about 20, but I've entitled it Job, Coming to Grips with the Mysteries of God, Man, and Suffering. The problem, 42 chapters in 30 minutes. But Job is an amazing book. It has some of the most wonderful poetry in all of human literature. Deep, heart-moving, really gets to the depths of what the human condition can actually feel. And it's all sandwiched in between two very short prose passage sections at the beginning and the end, which let the reader know what's going on. The story is, first of all, not a Jewish one. It takes place in Uz. We don't know where that is. Best guess is it's somewhere east of Jordan, to the southeast of Israel, but nobody knows for sure. Some say it's to the north, and we don't know where it is. But Job was not a member of the covenant people. He probably may even have predated the covenant people. He may well have been a contemporary of Abraham, clues within the book would suggest that it is from the patriarchal period, the same kind of lifestyle that Abraham was living. It may even be among the oldest pieces of oral tradition, and I say oral tradition, found in the Hebrew scriptures. But the story as we have it has been edited by a Jewish hand and presents a very Jewish theology. Most scholars date the final edition to somewhere between 1000 and 700 BC, but there is absolutely no agreement on that either. Some have it as recent as 200 BC for various reasons, but we're not getting into that. So what's the book about? Well, to understand the book's purpose, we must first understand a little bit about Job's context, which we gain from the first two chapters. At first glance, the book is about a righteous man named Job, who was very wealthy and very religious. We get a little bit of insight into just how religious he was from the fact that every time his sons would have a party, he would offer sacrifices for them just in case they had sinned. This could be out of concern for them, or it could be out of concern for God, or a combination of both. We learn from the first two chapters that Job was protected by God, but a time of testing came. And this raises the question that is never answered in the book and never satisfactorily answered in the Bible itself, insofar as I understand the issue at least. But I don't believe that anyone can honestly contradict me that the whole issue of theodicy, which is the problem of suffering and why the righteous suffer, is never addressed, never fully answered within the scriptures itself. Question, if God knows the test, what is the point of the test? If he knows the outcome of the test, what's the point of it? But this is a fact of God's dealing with us. He tested Israel in the wilderness. He tested his own son to the extreme. He tests believers. It's all part of the mystery of God dealing with us. In the first test, I should have the definite article there, the Satan, because Satan is not a name in the book of Job. It's a title for the accuser. It means the accuser is allowed to attack everything that Job owns, including his family, but is restricted from attacking Job himself. Job comes to the test with flying colors. Then Job got up and tore his robe. He shaved his head, and then he threw himself down with his face to the ground. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. May the name of the Lord be blessed." In all this, Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with moral impropriety. All his great possessions and even his children were to him a gift of God's grace, and he held them loosely. He possessed them. They did not possess him. Contrast with the rich young ruler in the gospel who came to Jesus asking how he might enter into life. And Jesus told him, you know the commandments, and he says, do those and you will enter life. He says, which ones? And Jesus says, but I've done all of this. What more do I lack? So after giving him the stock answers from the Jewish tradition, the young ruler was still dissatisfied and sensed that he still lacked something. And so Jesus told him to go sell everything that he had and give the proceeds to the poor and then come follow him. And we know the young man went away sad because he had great wealth. Did Jesus really want to separate him from his wealth? I don't think so. Jesus just went to the heart of the problem and put his finger on what was holding the young ruler's heart and was the reason that he was feeling unfulfilled in his life. He was possessed by his possessions, and Jesus, with one insightful invitation, revealed the young ruler to himself. Job's attitude is totally different. He is a model against which we may measure our own attachments to people and things. He could suffer the loss of everything and bless the Lord. In the second test, the Satan is given permission to attack Job's person, but is restricted from taking his life. Here again, Job passes the test. At this point, his wife has had enough. Then his wife said to him, are you still holding firmly to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he replied, you're talking like one of the godless women would do. Should we receive what is good from God and not also receive what is evil? In all of this, Job did not sin by what he said. Job's wife was clearly in the position of at least wanting to curse God. Because the focus of the book is on Job, we often forget that this was not, it was not just Job who lost all he possessed, including his family. His wife lost all of these things too. And there was probably a very real sense in which she lost her husband too in his physical and emotional affliction. In challenging Job about holding on to his integrity towards God, she was revealing that she felt it was inappropriate for him to do so in the context and from within the framework of their belief system. We're getting to the core of why the book of Job is written. Their belief system has three main points. God is almighty. God had behaved wrongly toward them. Cursing God was a fit response for that. To that. Oh, Job's friends. Job's comforters have been mortalized in a negative way because far from their intention of comforting their friend, they actually increased his suffering. With their well-intentioned intervention, they actually make matters worse. But they loved him. Maybe it might be just worth hearing what Job has to say about his friends. Devotion is due from his friends to one who despairs and loses faith in the Almighty. But my brothers have been as deceptive as a torrent. Like the watercourses of torrents that run dry, they turn dark with ice, they are hidden with piled up snow, but they vanish the moment they are in spate, dwindle in the heat and are gone. Caravans winding hither and thither go up into the desert and perish. The caravans of Tama look for water. The traveling merchants of Sheba rely on it, but they are disappointed for all their confidence. They arrive only to be frustrated. Just so unreliable have you been to me. You felt dismay and took fright. Did I ever say, give me this or that? Or say, use your wealth, save my life? Did I say, rescue me from my enemy's grip, or ransom me from the clutches of ruthless people? Tell me plainly. I shall listen in silence. Show me where I have been at fault. How harsh are the words of the upright. But what do your arguments prove? Do you mean to argue about mere words? Surely such despairing utterance is mere wind. Would you assail an orphan? Would you make attacks on your friend? So now, I beg you, turn and look at me. Am I likely to lie to your face? Think again. Let me have no more injustice. Think again, for my integrity is in question. Do I ever give voice to injustice? Have I not the sense to discern when my words are wild? Well, there's Job addressing his friends. But they loved him. Despite the callousness of their speeches, they left their homes to go to him. When they arrived, they tore their clothes and tossed dust into the air and over their heads, traditional acts of mourning. And they sat for 7 days and nights in silence, in solidarity with their friend in his great grief. Sometimes a situation can be so tragic that the only appropriate response is silence. Words will come later, they must. But for now, in this moment of grief, there can only be silence. The three friends are there to save their friend. But like Job's wife, their orthodoxy, and more about this later, led them to the wrong conclusion. And after Job broke his silence, their well-intentioned intervention just added to his suffering. Popular misconception. Most people think that the book of Job is about Job's patience and his perseverance in suffering. But if that's what the book is about, then it can be concluded at the end of chapter 2. But it goes on for another 40 chapters. By far the greatest test for Job was to maintain his integrity and his sense in of himself in the face of the argument and persuasions of his wife and four friends. I put four. I'm not sure if Elihu is really a friend. He appears sort of briefly. He's almost like the human judge, adjudicator of the debate that's going on between Job and his three friends. Carlo Martini perceptively points out that the great acts of submission to God that Job makes in the first two chapters must now be worked out in the daily grind of life. This is a real struggle. The act of submission, real and genuine as it is, like the act of faith and conversion, must be lived out day by day. By no means an easy task, and one that requires all our internal resources. And it is, you know, is the verdict in chapter 2 that Job did not sin before or after? Scholars are not agreed. The great debates is all of this reasoning and arguing between Job and his friends, Job's struggle to come to integrity? Leave that open. What's the book about? Well, St. Jerome, the church father who translated the Bible into Latin, the version we know as the Latin Vulgate, compared Job to an eel. The harder we try to lay hold of its meaning, the more it slips through our fingers. There is no book in the Bible that there is less agreement about its meaning than the book of Job. And part of the reason for that is the oldness of it. There are Hebrew words in the book of Job that are not found in any other book of the Bible. They're so old that they've already fallen into disuse. And that's why you'll find so much difference in translation, because scholars are guessing at what they mean by comparing them to other Semitic languages that they may have shared a common root with. The Greek translation has 100 verses less than the Hebrew translation because the translators didn't know how to translate it. It's a really difficult book. The idioms are so much different. They're more Aramaic or Arabic than Hebrew. Which has led some people to believe that it was written in Aramaic and translated into Hebrew. But I think one scholar is probably right when he says no, it has more to do with the geography of where it was written and what was spoken by the Jewish people in that place rather than translation, because translation would tend to smooth out and make it more understandable. Anyway, there's truth in what Jerome says, but at the same time, it is the inspired word of God, and God does intend that we benefit from it, and we can only do that by understanding it, at least to some degree. This is not to say that we ever fully master its meaning, because it deals with subjects that have vexed humanity through all its generations, specifically the problem of human suffering and the goodness and the justice of God. The manner in which the problem is conceived and addressed is uniquely an Israelite way of viewing it. The Greek and later Western way of framing it has been, how can the justice of an almighty God be defended in the face of evil, especially human suffering, and even more particularly the suffering of the innocent? In this form of the question, three possible assumptions are left open. One, that God is not almighty. Or two, that God is not just, that there is a demonic element in his being. Or three, that man may be innocent. But in ancient Israel, the unquestioned biblical way of coming at the problem had also three assumptions. God is almighty, he is perfectly just, and no human being is wholly innocent in his sight. That's the biblical way of coming at the issue. These three assumptions are also fundamental to the theology of Job and his friends. From these assumptions, there can only be one conclusion about suffering. Every person's suffering is indicative of the extent to which he or she is guilty before God. That is the theology of Job and his friends. As an abstract concept, this conclusion appeared inescapable, logically imperative, demanded by the evidence, and theologically satisfying. Hence, in the context of such theology, the issue of the justice of God and human suffering was not a problem, because the solution was self-evident. But what was thus theologically self-evident in the abstract, in the ivory tower of the theologian, was often in radical tension with actual human experience, because there are always those who are genuinely godly, morally upright, and who, though not sinless, keep themselves from serious sins, but who nevertheless suffer greatly. For these, the self-evident theology, that is, wisdom equals virtuous living equals success, that theology brings no consolation and offers no guidance. Such was the situation of Job. Now, the weakness of this self-evident theology. This self-evident theology, which is very pronounced in Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomical writings, as well as in the book of Proverbs, indeed, as one commentator wrote, it is writ large from Genesis to Malachi. It only gave rise to a great enigma, a great mystery. And God himself, to whom the sufferer had always previously turned in times of need and distress, became himself the overwhelming enigma, the overwhelming mystery. In Job 3:37, we hear on one hand the flawless logic and the wounding thrusts of Job's three friends, plus Elihu in chapter 37, who insist on the orthodox theology, and on the other hand, the anguish of the righteous sufferer Job, who suffers with the great enigma. That is, he knows he is righteous, and he also knows that God is just. But if the first is true, then his suffering is unjust because it is undeserved. And if the second is true, then God has somehow forgotten or overlooked him. And that's the agony in which Job finds himself. In the book, we have Job suffering this internal anguish because his experience is painfully out of sync with his theology, and his suffering is made far more severe by the wounds that are inflicted by his well-intentioned friends, who are also operating out of that theology. Job is thus a graphic portrayal of the unique form of the just God and human suffering issue experienced by righteous sufferers within Orthodox Israel, and may I add, in the church today. Good people are at times demonized and cast out by orthodox but inadequate theologies. Reflect for a moment. Think about Job. His faith is orthodox and includes the elements we described. God is almighty and he is perfectly just. At this point in time, there was no solid belief in life after death. And so blessing and suffering, reward and punishment must occur within the time frame of one's life as a consequence of what one has done. Job's experience is horrendous. He is first of all hit with the loss of everything he owned. This is quickly followed by his 7 sons and 3 daughters getting killed in a tornado. Then in the second test, he is subsequently afflicted with physical suffering and becomes an outcast from his own people as a consequence of the application of orthodox theology. Job's friends spend 34 chapters tormenting him with the theological answers that up to this point were the very foundation of Job's own belief system. His friends are well-intentioned, but according to theological orthodoxy, there can be only one explanation for all this suffering. Job must have sinned grievously, and they are determined to recover him, to restore him to God and to God's blessing. Job knows in himself he doesn't deserve this. Everything he has believed about justice and the righteousness of God is rocked to its foundations. But I cannot hold my peace. I will speak out in my anguish of spirit and complain in my bitterness of soul. Am I a monster of the deep? Am I the sea serpent that you set a watch over me? When I think that my bed will comfort me, that sleep will relieve my complaint, you terrify me with dreams.